We concluded Theatre Week with a sequence from Freud's last session, the play that came to Gonzaga in the form of two gentlemen who were performing it. They were in at the campus all week and then doing two performances Friday and Saturday night. Charlie Pepitone, who directed it, who is the Gonzaga faculty member, brought them in and had introduced Marty Reynolds as Sigmund Freud and Corey Norman as C.S. Lewis. The conversation continues.
So last March, I went down and directed it there at Wayland down in West Texas, and we performed there. And then the show moved to perform in Lubbock. And so when I came back this way to Gonzaga, I thought, we need to bring these guys up. Let's do the show at Gonzaga. And they've been in our classes all week, in theater classes, working with students, and then the show's here. So we rebuilt the set on our stage in the Magnuson, and here we are. Yeah.
And so that that is Magnuson Theater at Gonzaga University tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 for Freud's last session. Well, let's move right into Sigmund, but let's not. We'll get around to Sigmund. So, Marty Reynolds, you were Charlie's professor. You trusted him enough to say, come direct me?
Yes, absolutely. Charlie actually directed me. One of, I think, two students that directed me as an undergraduate. You know, most undergraduate students aren't directing their professors. But, yeah, even as an undergraduate, Charlie took that on, and he's had a great career, and I thought, this is perfect.
Yeah. And so you two have kept in touch.
Yes, we have.
Since then.
Both of these guys, we have stayed in touch.
And we'll get to Corey in a minute, but I'm going to throw it right back to you, Charlie. And what were the qualities, what was your relationship in college to this professor and what you learned from him?
Well, Marty was... I've seen it again this week when he's working now with my students. He just has a way of bringing out the best in students. He's got a mentorship relationship with students, even those that he just meets. And so it's been really amazing to see that happen again this week, and just stepping into an intro to theater class with students who don't know that much about theater, maybe, or a directing class where they might. And bring the best out of these students. So that's what I experienced as a student with Marty.
Now, the person in the room, Corey Norman, you were a classmate, were you, of Charlie?
Yes, I was.
And what directions have your life gone since leaving college?
Since leaving college, I had since gone back to grad school, got a degree in arts administration, and spent 6 years in Dallas as a managing director of a small professional theater company, Theater 3 there, and then moved back to Lubbock to do graduate admissions and recruitment for Texas Tech University. And that's where I was when I got the phone call or the email from Marty, seeing if I would be interested in being in the show. And of course I was. And when I heard Charlie was directing it, I was so excited. Hadn't seen Charlie in probably 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's it was terrific.
It was interesting because when I mentioned this play to Jack Phillips, who was just in from Civic, he said that he had seen the play a couple of times. So what is the kind of background and history of this play, Freud's Last Session?
I think it premiered off-Broadway in about 2010. And goes back even further than that. The play is based on a book written by Dr. Armand Nicolai, who is a Harvard psychologist. And he taught a class for 35 years at Harvard that has this imagined conversation at its heart of putting the worldviews and thoughts of Sigmund Freud right up against that of C.S. Lewis and sort of what happens from there. It became a four-part BBC or PBS special, where those issues were discussed, and we're talking God, sex, death, meaning of life, relationships, and then Marc St. Germain adapted that for it's about a 75-minute long one act, where it covers all that ground, and as esoteric as that might sound, it's about two people coming together and learning to overcome their differences, while not changing their minds at all, which seems like a pretty topical thing for us. Yeah. So.
And then on top of all that, right on the eve of World War II. So
it happens, yeah, on the day that England enters World War II in September of 1939. That's when this imagined conversation takes place.
Well, the treat amidst all this conversation is that we're going to get a little bit of this play for right now, a sequence from this play. Marty Reynolds as Sigmund Freud and Corey Norman as C.S. Lewis, although that'll probably become pretty obvious. Anything we need to know, or do we just launch in?
Well, we could do a quick plug for tickets. If people are interested, the show is Friday and Saturday night, so tonight and tomorrow night, 7:30 at the Magnuson Theater on Gonzaga's campus. Tickets are available on our website, gonzaga.edu/theaterarts, or by calling the box office, which is also on that website.
Great. Well, then let's launch into the play, because I'll bet we're going to know what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Dr. Freud, I'm Professor Lewis.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
I'd given you up for lost. Come this way, we can speak in my study.
I'm terribly sorry to be so late.
If I wasn't 83, I would say it doesn't matter.
The rail schedules are useless with the evacuations. All the trains are leaving London, not coming here. I watched coach after coach pass through Oxford Station with children they're taking to the countryside. They're emptying hospitals as well.
And prisons.
Really?
Anywhere air attacks are likely. Thousands of convicts near the end of the sentences are being released.
You've been listening to the radio?
Yes. I find it convenient to be warned before being bombed. Chamberlain is due to make an announcement. I must tell you that my doctor will be coming shortly, so a visit must be brief. Let me take your coat. My wife and our housekeeper are out shopping for any canned goods they can find. We must prepare for the worst.
Of course. Perhaps under the circumstances we should simply postpone it.
Until when, Professor? Do you count on your tomorrows? I do not.
What kind of dog is he?
A chow. He stays with me through all my sessions. Yofi is my emotional barometer. If a patient is calm, he stretches out at my feet. But if a patient is agitated, Yofi stands at my side, never takes his eyes off him.
So, what should I make of him running away at the sight of me?
He, too, is a stickler for punctuality.
I see. What a marvelous study.
My daughter Anna decorated it to be a replica of my office in Vienna. Oh,
you have a beautiful view.
The garden. Yes. When I looked out my window at home, I saw only Nazis burning my books. Please, sit. Not there. Here.
Thank you.
Since we have so little time, perhaps we should come to the reason I wrote you.
One of my books.
Ah, you've written more than one?
I believe it's Pilgrim's Regress that's offended you.
Offended?
Yes, my satirizing you with the Sigismund character. His bombastic self-importance, his tossing the pilgrim to the giant because he can't bear being contradicted. My describing you as a vain, ignorant old man was a bit excessive. But I feel when we put our belief systems before the public, we must expect the public to react.
As they should.
I'm sorry if you took it as a personal attack, but I can't apologize for taking issue with your worldview when it completely contradicts my own.
Which is?
That there is a God. That a man doesn't have to be an imbecile to believe in him, and we feeble-minded who do are not, as you claim, suffering from a pathetic obsessional neurosis.
I didn't read your book.
You didn't?
Dr. Eric Larson, a dear friend of mine at Cambridge, shares my passion for early English literature. When your homage to Pilgrim's Progress appeared, he gave me a full report.
That I savaged you.
Professor Lewis, I have been savaged all my life. Do not be disappointed that your creation of a cartoonish character named Sigismunda Enlightenment didn't leave me bedridden. But I must ask, if you assumed I was so offended, why did you come at all?
I was curious to meet you.
Even if you dismiss my work?
Not all of it, certainly. Your writings are always thought-provoking. When I was a student at university, we devoured every book to discover our latest perversions.
I hope you found some.
We did. Then competed to invent worse.
You enjoy using humor.
I debate my students daily. Humor often tips the scale.
Are you thinking even unconsciously that debate is the reason you're here?
I see. It makes no difference. I didn't choose the couch. Since you invited me here, perhaps you should tell me why.
Though I didn't read Pilgrim's Regress, I enjoyed your essay on Paradise Lost quite well written, with many original observations. Paradise Lost is my favorite book. Many years ago, when I was separated from my future wife, it gave me great comfort.
You were comforted by a clash between God and Satan.
I didn't say whose side I was on, but Milton gives Satan the best poetry, don't you think? Cigar?
No, thank you. Doesn't smoking aggravate your mouth?
Of course, but I'm determined to revel in my only sexual pleasure left. I've bid farewell to my phallic and anal stages and regressed to my oral.
Extraordinary.
What is?
That we've been talking this long and this is the first mention of sex.
Your definition is too narrow. I apply the term sexual to all interactions that bring pleasurable feelings. Genital contact, an infant sucking at its mother's breast, or the delight of a four-year-old girl sitting on her father's knee. Sexuality is the font of all happiness.
There's more to happiness than that. Sex is only one of many God-given pleasures, and certainly not the most lasting.
Extraordinary. We've been talking about sex for less than a minute before you brought God into it. Still, despite constant battle with church propaganda, we've made great progress overcoming our repressions.
Progress? We've gone from sex being a subject never spoken of to our being unable to talk about anything else. It's as if we invented it.
There's no appetite more powerful.
But it's grown ridiculous in proportion to its function. Compare it to our appetite for food. The audience at a striptease pays to watch a girl take her clothes off. But what if they instead paid for the sight of a naked mutton chop? Wouldn't you say they're taking their meat a bit too seriously?
But sex is more complicated than hunger.
On the contrary, we oversimplify it, turning it into the lie that sex, under any circumstances, is normal and healthy.
So you are an authority on what is normal and healthy?
There is a sexual code running through the Old and New Testaments. Sex is an act to be shared between two people who are committed to each other.
The Bible. For a moment, I thought you were thinking for yourself. The Bible is a bestiary of sexuality. You selectively quote texts like a priest determined to terrify his congregation. No sex before marriage? It's not only naive, it's mindless cruelty, like sending a young man off to play his first concerto with the orchestra, then the only time he's ever played his piccolo is alone in his room.
Then you practice free love.
Of course not. I'm a married man.
That's completely hypocritical.
Not at all. Philosophically, I advocate freedom of sexual choice. Personally, I choose not to make use of that freedom.
And when you were younger, before you were married?
I met Martha very early. We fell deeply in love.
And you've remained monogamous ever since?
Are you married?
No.
Do you live with anyone? A woman? A man?
Pardon?
Does homosexuality offend you? It should not. All human beings are intrinsically bisexual.
I live with my brother and the mother of a close friend who was killed in the war.
Why is that?
I promised my friend I'd look out for her, and he'd do the same for my father if we didn't make it back. Mrs. Moore and I look out for each other, actually.
But your brother? Wouldn't he have taken care of your father?
My brother was also fighting. We didn't know what our future was.
It seems it was Mrs. Moore How long have you been in this relationship?
I wouldn't call it a relationship.
Any bond between two people is a relationship.
When I was in hospital in France, Mrs. Moore came to care for me. She was a great comfort.
How old was she?
Mrs. Moore was in her early 40s.
Does Mrs. Moore have a first name?
Janie.
Janie. Did you think Janie an attractive woman when you met?
She was the mother of my friend.
Which might make her more attractive.
I resent your implication, and my personal life is not of your concern.
Your conversion is. You lived with her in your days as an atheist. Many men who lose their mothers at an early age are drawn to mature women. Now you still live with her, but you proclaim your sexual abstinence. So what I would like to know is whether your conversion cause this newfound virginity.
I won't discuss this further.
As you wish, but I always consider what people tell me less important than what they cannot.
A scene from Freud's last session, clearly the scene from the very beginning, since we're talking about the late arrival and all those things. And I'm the interviewer, and I'm supposed to think of something to say, but now I'm a little afraid to ask Dr. Freud anything. And so it proceeds for another 60 minutes or so, this conversation that already in 10 minutes just erupted into so much material. Then does it just continue to unfold from there with? Talk a little bit about where it goes without giving anything away.
Yes, it does. I mean, these two men are so much in opposition to each other intellectually, personality-wise, and so they stay in conflict through much of the play with very little room for concession, though that is a significant part of the play is when concessions happen.
Yeah. And this, you've done it already at what, two different colleges in Texas? At Wayland, where you teach, and mm-hmm. then in Lubbock, too, Texas Tech. And so talk about doing this play within a college, within a group of students. How does that fall on them?
Well, it's great. I mean, I think one of the things that students are looking at, whether fortunately or unfortunately, is all this diatribe and talking heads and anger about someone that feels different than how you feel. And so, you know, the whole notion of being able to disagree with someone and yet finding some kind of basis for commonality and some kind of basis for real dialogue and meaningful exchange without, you know, losing one's mind mm-hmm. and losing one's emotional context and so forth, I think is an important thing. But these ideas, of course, are timeless, and these ideas, you know, come out that students still struggle with. You know, when we were both at Wayland and just this past week when we're at Gonzaga, people are, you know, students are saying, wow, that really resonates with me because I have someone in my family who feels this way. I have somebody else who feels the other way. And I've been torn with these ideas, you know. And so, yeah, it's great.
And almost with a metaphor of the two characters here, has there been any difference between doing it at a Christian Baptist school and a state school in terms of the questions that are asked?
I don't know that there are differences. I do think that at Gonzaga there's more openness about students' willingness to talk about the extremes of their personal experience. And I think at Wayland, for example, they were a little more guarded. Mm-hmm. You know, they might not feel any differently, but they might be a little more protective of how mm-hmm. other students might respond to them. And here they're just very open, which is really refreshing.
Yeah. And then back to Charlie, you're bringing a discussion into this, tonight?
Tonight we have a panel discussion that's, this production is in a way co-produced by the Gonzaga Socratic Society and the Institute for Faith and Reason. And so tonight we're going to have
Right there, you've said it.
That's it, right? That's the whole thing. So tonight we have a panel discussion with the three of us, and then we're joined by David Calhoun, Brian Clayton, and Father Timothy Clancy from the Department of Philosophy. So The production itself is a wide-ranging conversation between Freud and Lewis, and then we're going to continue that. And from these guys' philosophical expertise, we're going to be looking at these two positions, some more of the nuance between them, and then also looking at perhaps what is a third way. It's not all just this binary, there is a God, there isn't a God. There's much more interesting, romantic, mystical opportunities for conversation in there as well, which is where I think the conversation will go tonight, which is interesting.
So that'll be after the play?
Following the play tonight, they're also in the Magnuson, and then we'll have a reception afterwards.
Because the good news is nobody has to get up early tomorrow morning, so why not?
That's exactly right. Yeah, why not?
7:30 for this hour and a quarter play at Gonzaga tonight and tomorrow night, and then the panel discussion tonight following it. What a treat. What a treat to encounter 10 minutes of this play. Thank you, Marty Reynolds, for coming to Spokane. And thank you, Corey Norman, for coming to Spokane.
So glad to be here.
Good for Gonzaga. So that is tonight and tomorrow night.